The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Wine Banks, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. Kim is out this week, but she'll be back soon. So before we get started, if you have not visited our merch shop lately, you will want to take a look at the new Sisters-in-Law Resistance mini tote, which you can pre-order right now. If you're a knitter like me, you're going to want this as your newest project bag, but there are a thousand other uses for these things. They're fantastic, so head over after you listen to the podcast and take a look. You can find them at politicon.com/merch and get yours now. This week, there's so much to discuss. We've got the end of police oversight from DOJ, the charges the U.S. attorney in New Jersey has brought against a sitting congresswoman, and also what you need to know about a legal precedent called Humphrey's Executor and what the Supreme Court did to it earlier this week. So I've been out for the last 2 weeks, and I've missed my sisters and all of y'all more than I can say. But I was gone for a good reason. I was gone for the college graduation of two of my kids, actually a college graduation and a master's graduation, opposite ends of the country. Utter insanity. And it's such a difficult time for the students coming out right now. I've felt at a loss to give them good advice. And they really wanted it, not just my own kids, but their friends and my law students. I mean, this is a moment where people need and deserve our collective wisdom. And so, sisters, I'm wondering what advice you might have to give to your graduation self, or maybe even to today's kids. If you could go back in time, knowing what you know right now, what would you tell yourself? Barb, you're always so good with advice. What would you do?
I'll tell you what to do,
you
Joyce.
Here's
what you ought to do.
You're always good.
It's a very polite way of saying, you busybody, get out of my business.
No.
You know what I would tell my younger self, and it was certainly not advice that I was aware of at the time, but don't be in such a hurry to get on with your life. It's a long life, you know, God willing. And there's a lot of time to do a lot of different stuff. I think when I was younger, I was in a big hurry to get my first job and to get earning money and to be, you know, moving on in the world. I felt like it was time to get moving. And I think that, you know, you say youth is wasted on the young. I wish I had spent more time traveling and exploring and trying lots of different kinds of jobs, you know, than feeling the pressure of, you know, having a real job, a career job, because I think that even if a job isn't going to last forever, you still learn a lot of things from it. You can learn a lot of things as, you know, waiting tables, anything that deals with the public and the retail world. Woo, do you learn a lot of lessons?
Everybody should have that experience of waitressing for a while, right?
You know, being a laborer, you know, just things where, you know, people are not always so nice to you and you have to learn to take it. So, but also, you know, traveling and meeting different kinds of people. So I would just say, don't be in such a hurry to figure out exactly what your life is going to look like.
That's great advice. Jill, what do you have?
You know, I gave a commencement speech recently, and I struggled with what do you say and not bore the audience and have them wishing you would sit down fast. And I actually don't know that I have any great advice. I have been very happy with how I've lived my life. And so when I look back and think, what would I do differently? What do I wish I had known? I don't know. I think it's like taking it, sort of what Barbara's saying is, don't be in a rush. Take one thing at a time. And when you're not happy with it, move on to something else. Don't be afraid to take calculated risks. Learn the value of friendships. I can't tell you how much friends have meant to me in my life. And find a mentor. That's something, maybe that's the one thing I had no idea you needed a mentor or what the value of a mentor was. And now I do. And I think that's an important element. But I think trying different things, and I agree with Barb, to me, travel is the most enriching thing you can possibly do. If I have one regret in my whole life, it's that I didn't do a junior year abroad. But it wasn't sort of something that people at the University of Illinois did back then, although my roommate my first year of law school had done that. But she was a rare person who did it. And I made up for it when I got a fellowship from the European Community and got to do some significant travel and interview people abroad, which was fantastic. So I'm kind of made up for it. But that's a great thing, is to be able to live somewhere else. And the same is true for our foreign students who visit us, who I hope will continue to be able to come to America and feel welcome here.
You know, that is all such good advice. I agree with y'all so much. Jill, I went junior year abroad in Germany. And in addition to my ability to swear fluently in three languages, because my roommate was Turkish, and I adored her and am grateful for that skill set, I just learned a lot about people and a lot about American presumptions about the rest of the world. And, you know, from my youngest child, who really does feel that pressure to go straight to school, I really do wish he would take a year and travel. I just think that's a gift you give to yourself. You can't work for 6 years and then just say, oh, I think I'm going to take a year off and travel. It doesn't work that way. So good advice all around.
I actually wish I could be my grand goddaughter, who has done the most amazing time offs and spent time on a farm in Hawaii twice, on a kibbutz in Israel, in Greece with her aunt, in France with a foreign student who had lived with her family when he was a foreign student in Milwaukee, and has just had the most brilliant, wonderful experiences living abroad.
There's just nothing like it.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, nothing like starting off straight ahead on a serious note, but the Justice Department has taken a pass on its traditional role in police oversight. This is something new with the Trump administration. You know, we have talked so many times about the kinds of work the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division does. And one of the most important examples is its oversight of local police departments with histories of systemic abuses. In DOJ speak, I would call that pattern and practice. And we've seen these cases in places like Los Angeles, California, following Rodney King, or in Ferguson, Missouri. But that era of DOJ oversight seems to have come to an end because DOJ has announced it is dismissing investigations and proposed consent decrees in Louisville, Kentucky, and Minneapolis. Those are the cities where the police killings of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd spurred shock, outrage, and demands for accountability and reform.
Trump's brand new assistant attorney general for the Civil Rights Division is Harmeet Dhillon. She's barely had time to find her way around the building, but apparently she was completely comfortable making this sea change from prior practice. She told reporters, "It's our view at the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division under the Trump administration that federal micromanagement of local police should be a rare exception and not the norm." Of course, that's crazy because it's always been rare, just as a matter of scarce federal resources. The division could never afford to do all of the cases, even the most urgent ones that presented themselves, because of limits on personnel and money. And by the way, this new move that she's making, it affects, in addition to the two cities that I mentioned, more than half a dozen others that were under signed or proposed consent decrees, and DOJ will no longer be enforcing them. There are nearly 30 active consent decrees involving law enforcement and jail systems in cities like Chicago, New Orleans, Seattle, and Los Angeles. They've all had jail systems or police departments operating under this kind of federal oversight because of patterns of unlawful conduct. So before we get started with the topic, I'll just speak from my personal experience and say, when police departments break trust with the communities that they're supposed to protect, the entirety of law enforcement in a community breaks down and it has to be fixed. If you just let it continue along, the results are bad for people and bad for police. And in the worst situations, consent decrees with the Justice Department are the road back. A consent decree is a legally binding performance improvement plan. It's a court-enforced settlement agreed to by all of the parties and approved by a court. But now DOJ says it won't be enforcing them anymore. So, Jill, the new administration can set new policies, different ones from their predecessors, but there's more going on here, right? I mean, we're talking about violating citizens' constitutional rights. So why do you think DOJ is making this move? What's going on?
It's just more about their accretion of power and of totally taking over with their view of the world. Everything they're doing is part of this. In this case, you know, you're right. The priorities of an administration are something that we elect people to do, and so they can alter the priorities. They can't just wholesale eliminate departments. And that's what they're doing in not just the Department of Justice, but of course the Department of Education, USAID, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we've gone way beyond what is normal, which would be modifying and changing, but not totally eliminating. And, you know, when you say consent decrees should be rare, and they are, it doesn't mean they should be non-existent. And so the two that they're eliminating weren't agreed to by a court yet. They were close to that stage. The others that are in danger that they're probably going to do nothing with will have to be enforced by the local people by just continuing to agree to the terms. Because the reason that there were consent decrees is that the civil rights of citizens of that locale were in danger because of the police conduct. And as you said, that ends the trust in the departments of law enforcement and can't be continued. So this is much, much more. And why is it happening? It's happening because this administration doesn't believe in the rule of law or civil rights.
To me, there's a huge racial overtone here too. Like I always think about Ferguson, Missouri, right? In 2014, an 18-year-old black man, Michael Brown, gets killed by the police. And in the subsequent investigation, it comes to light, not only was he not threatening them, he had his hands up. I mean, just no possible rationale for killing this young man. But there were disparities. Ferguson was black. The police department was white. They had a long history of treating people poorly. By poorly, I mean unlawfully and violently. And DOJ did this really serious investigation in Ferguson. And Barb's and my former colleague, Vinita Gupta, as head of the Civil Rights Division, was involved in producing this massive report that became the roadmap for curing the problems in Ferguson. And, you know, something that I worry that goes unnoticed here is, yes, there are consent decrees in some cases, not all cases, but there are these investigations, there are reports. Oftentimes, police departments want to fix their own problems because they don't want to get sued, right? And so these DOJ reports give them some safe harbor and some guidance, or maybe the city council demands that they fix the problems. There is a lot of good work going on here, and now it all sort of disappears. So, I mean, Barb, you've been involved in this stuff too. What do you think the fallout is going to be? There are cities like Minneapolis that have said they'll continue to abide by the terms of their decree. Memphis has said, you know, no, we're good. Sort of the way that Memphis has always approached law enforcement. What does this mean for citizens in those communities?
Yeah, I think this is a terrible step back in terms of police and community trust. As you said, you know, these pattern and practice cases have been around since legislation was passed following the Rodney King riots and police beating in Los Angeles in whatever was it, 1992 or thereabouts. And we had one in Detroit that resulted in an improved police department. The police department agreed to a consent, you know, that's the consent in the word consent decree is they agreed that they had a problem. They agreed that they had use of excessive force cases. They had confinement conditions that were deplorable where people were dying in their cells. And they were even engaging in rounding up witnesses to crimes. They called them material witnesses without any probable cause to believe they'd committed a crime. You know, they would arrest the wife or the girlfriend and keep her locked up until she told them where her loved one was when they were looking for somebody. So it was through a lot of hard work, through bringing in expertise to help them to implement new policies, to bring in new training, and new leadership that changed the culture of the department. It's now a, you know, no department is perfect. It still has problems, but it is really a shining example of constitutional policing. And I think that could happen in lots of cities because when you get a consent decree, it brings with it resources to help you address some of these problems. It brings with it expertise to help you address these problems in a way that a police chief just can't do on his own. So I do worry about what's going to happen in Memphis. It'll be back to business as usual. And if the police know that there will be no federal investigations, there will be no pattern or practice cases, there will be no consent decrees or complaints filed against them, then I worry, you know, we've had police misconduct even with that sort of oversight. What's it going to look like now that they know nobody's paying attention and nobody's going to be watching? So I worry about what we're going to see in regards to police conduct misconduct in the coming years. And then to Jill's point also about, like, why would they want to do this? Why would they even want to ignore federal legislation after it was passed by Congress? It is the will of Congress to try to uphold police departments to these high standards. And I think it really comes down to a lack of regard for what the law really is and truly implementing public safety and protecting civil rights. And it's all about creating this narrative of us versus them. We're the pro-police people. Democrats are the anti-police people. We do everything we can to help police officers do their jobs. And that, to me, is a really false narrative about what these cases are about, because they really are about helping law enforcement do a better job, because when they have the trust of the communities they serve, people are more likely to call when they are victims of crime or witnesses to crime and to obey the law and to help the police. So I think it's a really short-sighted, political, opportunistic strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the narrative of tough on crime, not the narrative of smart on crime, which is, you know, data-based, community-engaged policing. So, I mean, I think you've asked the right question, though, Barb. How do we protect people? I mean, there are some public information request campaigns being carried out by citizens, local organizations, the ACLU. Can this sort of civil society taking over for government work? How do you think that'll play out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think government is what has the teeth. It's why that statute was passed in the first place. Now, states have some ability to investigate their police departments. If they engage in criminal misconduct, certainly police officers can be charged with crimes by state prosecutors. But as we know, it's very difficult to hold police officers criminally accountable. And, you know, in my view, there's a reason for that. It's because we want to empower police officers to make the split-second decisions they need to make on the job. And so as a result, the legal standard for charging a police officer with a crime is really quite high. But these pattern apprentice cases really are the way to go after systemic problems in police departments where they just had, you know, bad policies, bad trainings, bad management. And the officers themselves are kind of stuck in a situation where they don't have the resources they need to succeed. And so I think that enforcing the pattern of practice statute is actually a way to improve policing that helps police officers. And I think without this statute, we're going to be in for a rough ride for the next few years.
It's like so many things, and I think you made this point, Barb, is that the law provides the resources that cities need to improve the police department and the expertise from a nationwide knowledge base. And that's what we'll be missing. And, you know, the ACLU's efforts are phenomenal. And all of the Freedom of Information Act cases are helpful. But it can't be a full substitute for pattern and practice lawsuits. There's just no getting around that that is not going to be adequate. It's something, it's better than nothing, but it's not good enough.
I agree 100% because I think the reason that departments and certainly jails, which are some of the most intractable problems, the reason that they were ever willing in the first place to engage in some sort of voluntary restoration of their processes was because of this huge stick that the federal government was holding. You know, no municipality wants to get sued by DOJ and forced into a consent decree situation. It just makes them look bad. You want to be the good guy who does it on your own. Well, now there's no risk that the Justice Department will require you to engage in constitutional policing. And I am deeply concerned about what this is going to mean and what we're going to be seeing. You know, the Supreme Court, Barb, to your point about standards, just decided a case that will make the standard for bringing a civil action for police abuse a little bit fairer. Do you have any thoughts about that? Will that play a role here?
You know, it might. I mean, anytime you change one part of the equation, it can have ripple effects. You know, it's why when you, if your doctor wants to change your medication, they always say change one thing at once, because if we change two things, we won't know what the cause is and what the effect is. So this is going to be kind of some simultaneous changes. And I think it will be difficult to see what the effect is. But I think anytime you change the law, it does create opportunities. It certainly will create test cases. I'm sure we'll see some lawsuits to try to test what the parameters of the new law is. But of course, it depends on how courts decide to implement the law and interpret it. So I think it remains to be seen how things will play out in the future.
Let me just add, I really think the Supreme Court decision is important on its own, but it's particularly important when the Department of Justice is abandoning its traditional role. The case really does change the standard to make it clear that a police officer is not exempt from lawsuits and liability if he makes a last-second decision that he is in danger and fires his gun and kills someone. This says you have to look at the totality of circumstances. Did the police officer provoke the danger to himself, as in this case he did, by jumping onto a car and pointing a gun into it, where he couldn't even see into the car because his head was over the top of the car. So I think this adds some protection that we're missing from the Department of Justice. And so I think it's a really good decision and will help for the time being. It'll help permanently, but particularly in the absence of Department of Justice enforcement.
Well, let me be the Debbie Downer in the room and just say, I'm sorry. It's like I'm assuming the role of the Grouch, I guess. But
wah, I mean, wah. We need a sad trombone. Remember,
do,
there was the
right?
SNL Debbie Downer with wah, wah.
Go ahead.
That's exactly what I'm going to do, because the facts in this case, this is crazy. The officer wanted, you know, he thought that what the evidence that should be admissible was just this very limited couple of seconds, the last couple of seconds, where he makes the decision to fire his gun, not everything that happens beforehand. And the Supreme Court sort of says, no, buddy, it's mostly all coming in. I mean, not 2 hours worth of stuff, but, you know, you got to let the jury or whoever's going to decide the case, a judge, see the entire trajectory leading up to the moment when you pull the trigger. That seems so obvious to me that it's shocking that we had to go to the Supreme Court to get that ruling. And I got to say, I am just not optimistic about the future in this area.
Well, I agree with you that it's shocking that we're discussing this and that it had to go to the Supreme Court. But let's celebrate that the Supreme Court made a decision that makes a lot of sense. And, we're sort of skirting around what the facts of the case were. The police officer makes a traffic stop for what appears to be non-payment of tolls. It turns out the car is rented, and the prior renter is the one who violated the tolls. So the driver of the car has no knowledge about this. And when asked for certain documents, he says, well, I don't have them. I think they might be in the trunk. He pops open the trunk. And for some reason, he then decides that he's going to flee. And he starts the car, and the police officer, for no reason, this is a minor traffic stop, jumps onto the car and holds on as the car is moving. Now, of course, he is in danger at that moment because he chose to do this. There was no reason to stop. He had the license plate of the car. He knew who it was. Why would you engage and endanger yourself and then kill the driver? And of course, think about it. You kill the driver, the driver's going to lose control of the car. You are in more danger by doing that than if you just jump off the car. So it was a really stupid set of facts that led to a good decision. And so you're not going to depress me, Joyce. You are not going to. I'm still happy.
Appreciate that that upbeat attitude, Jill.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, first it was a judge, and now we've seen a member of Congress charged by Trump's Department of Justice. On Tuesday, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey charged Representative LaMonica McIver, a Democrat representing that state in Congress, with assaulting, impeding, and interfering with an immigration officer. So, Joyce, first, can you set the stage for us? Where was Representative McIver? Why was she there? And what led up to these charges?
Yeah, so Representative McIver, very unremarkably, goes along with two other members of Congress and Newark's mayor to an ICE detention facility. It's a privately managed one. And she was there to engage in congressional oversight. This is lawful. It's routine. That's well established. Members of Congress have the ability to show up unannounced to do oversight, and they have to be admitted. They can't be excluded. So they look inside of the facility, and they go outside, and there is just this melee out on the street. Masked ICE agents, just, you know, I've seen the video. I'm sure you all have too. Just everybody's sort of throwing around. And it results in the arrest of Newark's mayor, Roz Baraka. He and Representative McIver are old friends and political buddies with long-standing relationship. And she Her story is that she was trying to protect him from arrest, trying to hug him. She maybe makes some incidental contact with ICE agents. I'm sure people have also seen the government has taken still photo outtakes and shown those where she's in contact. So Baraka gets arrested and charged with misdemeanor trespass by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Newark, led by former Trump lawyer Alina Haba, who has, virtually no experience as a prosecutor. I don't think she's got any. She has to dismiss those misdemeanor charges.
So, Joyce, you mentioned that they used some screenshots in the complaint, which is, you know, kind of a newish idea, isn't it? When I was practicing, it was new. And now it's in complaints all the time, which I think is great because you can show photo evidence. It's easy enough to embed that in a complaint. But I watched the video and then I saw the screenshots, and I'm sure the video has been released by the government, right? That's who would have access to it. Do you think that the video or even the screenshots demonstrate that she indeed assaulted, impeded, or interfered with the police or the immigration officers?
You know, 111, 18 U.S. Code 111, the statute she's charged under, the federal assault statute, it's a difficult statute with a lot of moving pieces. Every year before I teach it to my first-year law students, I sort of have to take a deep breath because it has everything in it from a misdemeanor provision that doesn't involve, you don't actually have to touch somebody to assault them. The essence of the crime mm-hmm. is putting someone in fear mm-hmm. that you will do something that might harm them or threatening them. And so it's everything from a misdemeanor to these very serious felonies, right? Assault with the intent to kill or assault with a deadly weapon, sort of these high-endy crimes. I suspect that as a purely technical matter, there's some place in this statute where the government could make out a hyper-technical case for assault. But look, one of the essential elements of the government's proof here is that she was acting voluntarily. And I think that, you know, anytime, right, your conduct has to be voluntary. If you're sleeping, for instance, and you put your arm out in your sleep and you hit somebody, it's not an assault. It's not voluntary movement. Even before you were to get to the issue of intent, I'm really sorry going deep into law school.
No, this is great.
Boring.
This is exactly why I asked you this question. I've been thinking about this. This is first year, day one criminal law actus reus, right?
I mean, this is a voluntariness issue. I'm not positive that the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was acting voluntarily. I mean, she's like trying to fend stuff off. She's trying to protect him.
Did you see the other video that some bystander took from a different angle, which seems to clearly show that she was being pushed, which means not only wasn't it voluntary, she was literally physically pushed into other people. So I think they're going to have a really hard time making this case.
So, you know, this is a point that I made last night in my newsletter. I mean, this is a statute that applies to an assault on a federal official. Members of Congress qualify under this statute too. And as a purely theoretical matter, it's interesting to contemplate whether the ICE agents could be charged with assaulting her.
Yes.
You know, that's a much better case, right? They're wearing masks. They've got the badge and the gun. She's a member of Congress doing her job. And all of a sudden she's surrounded by these people. This is what I was going to say is before we even get to issues of like privilege, I think this case probably falters just on the facts, even though there might be a hyper-technical place in the statute where you could find all the elements of proof. Tough getting to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There are all these immunity issues that are going to come up. It's such an unappealing case. And Barb, I don't know about you, but as a practical matter in my office, I can think of only a couple of times that we charged misdemeanors. And they were always in very compelling civil rights cases. I mean, absent something like that where there was no other remedy, where the state couldn't intervene, where the conduct was heinous, where you had to do something, we just didn't fool with charging misdemeanors.
Yeah, same. Just, you know, we have finite bandwidth. And so we focused, our efforts on frying bigger fish. But I think that, you know, the standard for a complaint is probable cause. If you look at these photos, is there probable cause to believe that she not only, and remember, the statute isn't just assault. It could also be if she impeded or interfered with their work. And according to the complaint, she said, oh, hell no, when they were trying to arrest the mayor. And she even said, surround the mayor. And people according to the complaint, were trying to surround the mayor. So I think they probably have at least probable cause. But of course, when prosecutors initiate a case, they should believe that they also have sufficient evidence to prove the case beyond the reasonable doubt to obtain and sustain a conviction at trial. And do they have that? I think no chance.
I can't imagine a jury convicting on this evidence.
But the other thing, at a minimum, this jury is going to hang. You are not going to get a unanimous verdict of guilt.
But the even more important point, I think, is not just can you get a conviction, but the question is, should you charge this case? And that's where prosecutorial discretion comes into play. And you have to think about a lot of factors, including the respect between co-equal branches of government. Now, you know, members of Congress are not above the law. And if a member of Congress storms in there and grabs a immigration officer and prevents him from doing his job, I'm going to charge that all day. But here we've got kind of a scrum. As you say, the video shows that, you know, all we see is the chaos has already started. We don't see whether she's starting it or she kind of gets caught up in it. I doubt she showed up that day with the plan that she was going to mess with these masked immigration officers. It kind of just evolved organically. And so I think from a should charge, an exercise of discretion, I can't imagine wanting to charge this case and taking it to trial. And yet, it seems like they are just only too gleeful to say, here's our chance. Gotcha. We are going to send a strong message to everybody in Congress that if you mess with us and our immigration agenda, we are coming for you, because just being charged can be very problematic. Well, Jill, let's move on. Joyce mentioned the mayor. Ross Baraka was also arrested at the same event, but the U.S. Attorney's Office ended up not pursuing charges against him, but pursuing charges against Representative McIver instead. And that caused a magistrate judge to criticize them when they dropped the charges against Baraka and continued with the charges against McIver. What do you think about their decision and about the judge's comments about the decision?
The judge was completely correct in criticizing them. They did not, and when I say they, I'm going to have to say that we're talking about a particular person who is the interim U.S. attorney, Alina Haba, who, as you mentioned, was a lawyer for Trump before this. And there was no time for an investigation, for any thoughtful evaluation of the facts. And as the facts turn out, he was charged with trespass, but he was admitted into the area. Now, he was admitted by ICE officers who thought he was a member of Congress and with the congressional delegation, who does have a clear legal right to be there. When they realized he was the mayor now running for governor, they said, you have to leave. And he did. And after he exited the secure area, they handcuffed him and arrested him. So it's a pretty ridiculous set of facts, and they were right to drop the case. They should have never arrested him. They should never have issued a complaint. And I think the judge was right to chastise her. And I think we're going to talk about her history, but she's been chastised by a lot of judges, actually.
Yeah, I don't mind the decision to drop the charges. I think what the judge took issue with was jerking him around, right? Yeah. This is not a tool to get someone's attention. It is a serious decision that should be made carefully after assessing all of the facts and then going forward. It isn't, you know, I'm going to file charges. No, I'm not. Now I got this bigger fish in McIver and I'm going to go after him instead. So I think that's...
Well, I think it goes along with her comments that she's going to turn New Jersey red and that she's, I mean, she's really sort of pretty much announced she's going after Democrats. And that's what this is more about than whether or not, I mean, I'm sure she approves of dismissing all the charges against the January 6th rioters. And you can hardly compare the behavior of Representative McIver with what happened there.
That kind of behavior is not going to help the office that Alina Haba leads. It's not going to help them. I mean, if I'm a lawyer, I'm going to go to the judge and say, this is a classic case of vindictive and selective prosecution based on her comments. And I think, frankly, although those motions are usually tough to make out, I bet we're going to see some early successes here.
Joyce, did you see who is representing Representative McIver? Paul Fishman?
I did. Our former colleague, the Obama era U.S. attorney in New Jersey. Before that, he was a counselor in Maine justice to Janet Reno when she was the attorney general. Look, Paul is one of the smartest lawyers I know.
Oh, yeah.
She is very well represented. I think he'll get this case dismissed early on. But if it were to go in front of a jury, I can't think of a lawyer I would rather have than Paul Fishman explaining this case to a jury. It does not bode well for the government.
Yeah, so Paul Fishman is the former U.S. attorney in New Jersey, the job that Alina Haba now inhabits. And so I'm sure he will be very effective in explaining to her and her office why this is such a garbage case. But if they, you know, want to go to trial, you know, bring it on. Because I think, as we've discussed, she's got a pretty strong defense.
Can I just add to that, though, and say there was reporting, and not really reporting, right? It's Haba's statement where she says, well, we tried to resolve this case before we indicted it.
Yeah, I did.
And that didn't work. I bet you she was talking about that misdemeanor provision in 111. And I think Fishman told her to go fish, right? I mean, you're not going to convict my client on a misdemeanor or anything else.
I don't know about what happened in the attorney-client privilege domain.
I'm just speculating wildly.
But if it were me and they said, yes, you've been involved in this scrum and we'll tell you what, we'll do you a big favor. We'll make it all go away if you just plead guilty to a misdemeanor. I'm like, go away. No chance. I'm not doing that. It's crazy. So that seems consistent with what the reporting is. I agree with you. Well, let me just ask both of you, between the arrest of a judge, now the arrest of a mayor, although released, the arrest of a member of Congress. There's a lot of norm breaking. Again, certainly no one is above the law. And if somebody were to commit a serious crime, bring them on, arrest them. But do you think that this is about advancing an immigration agenda? Do you think it is about enforcing the law? Do you think it's more of a power flex? What do you each think about why we're now seeing this very aggressive use of the power of the prosecutor?
This is exactly what we don't want to see. You know, this is a case where prosecutors are being used to achieve political aims. This is the politics of scare tactics and intimidation being used to quiet dissenting voices. Just like the prosecution of the judge in Wisconsin, Hannah Dugan, this is the Trump administration. And by the way, Alina Haba talks about, you know, being the Trump U.S. attorney, right? She's not making any pretense that she's acting as an independent prosecutor. And this is a political prosecution that's being done to make people think twice before they oppose this administration's moves. Because as you said, Barb, being arrested isn't really very fun. And even if you're ultimately acquitted, it's stressful, it's costly, it's a drag on your daily life and your family and the people around you. This is intimidation. It is nothing else. It's appalling. And this is a significant step on the path towards autocracy or dictatorship, whatever we're calling it these days. I mean, I think this is a huge red flag. And people who haven't woken up yet, they need to wake up.
Jill, anything to add to that?
Joyce said it all so brilliantly, but I would just say this is the best example of weaponization of the Justice Department that I have ever seen. It is despicable. It is a lack of respect for the rule of law. It is just part of, it's the same as the retaliation against Harvard for standing up for its rights. It's the same as all of these other actions. And Joyce is right. This is to silence opposition. That's how someone becomes a dictator. And if we don't stand up to each and every one of these attempts to silence opposition, then we are in trouble as a country.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
On Thursday, SCOTUS gave President Trump a huge win in a case called Donald Trump, President of the United States versus Gwynne Wilcox and Kathy Harris. Those are two members of independent agencies, the NLRB for Wilcox and the Merit System Protective Board for Harris. Trump fired both Wilcox and Harris and has never argued that he had cause. He just wanted them gone because they didn't fit his political agenda. The district court ordered both reinstated, and the Court of Appeals upheld that decision. The Supreme Court stayed the reinstatement, meaning both are effectively fired right now. They are out of a job. The SCOTUS order never mentions the most important precedent, Humphrey's Executor, a case that has for over 100 years protected government agencies that Congress created to be led by bipartisan leadership and who could not be fired without cause. They set specific terms for each of those people. The purpose was to prevent changes of administration from politically influencing those agencies' actions, actions that were to be based on the expertise of the agency, not politics. Here, as I said, the government does not even remotely claim that there was cause for firing either board member. So what does the government claim? Is this just another attempt by the Trump administration to create a unitary executive with unlimited powers, even when Congress specifically limits his ability to fire certain employees? Joyce, let's clarify what this is and that it's not a merits decision.
Yeah, so I mean, as in so many of the cases that we've been discussing since Trump took over, this is on the government's request to obtain relief from a stay that prohibited it from firing folks while the case worked its way through the courts. And the Supreme Court says that they can. It's a disappointing but utterly predictable decision that does away with the longstanding precedent in Humphrey's Executor, which is sort of a fun case. I mean, we've been nerdy in this show. Let's just talk a little bit about that case. Because Humphrey was a presidential appointee during the Calvin Coolidge administration to the Federal Trade Commission. He was a commissioner. He died after holding that office under two subsequent presidents, but he had a falling out with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Roosevelt was trying to fire him. He stayed on and said he was entitled to the job. He dies, and his executor is trying to actually collect his salary as part of the estate. And so that's the dispute. The government lost. The funds were turned over. Roosevelt didn't have the ability to fire him. And you would think that that would end the matter, right? That's this situation. But not for Donald Trump. The government argued in this case that the president can fire members of independent federal agencies, and it's part and parcel of the unitary executive theory that we've been talking about so much. This notion that the Constitution assigns the president a unitary power, a power that can't be divided up, to control everything in the executive branch, including these quasi-independent agencies. So the government says that that's the dispute and that Humphrey's executor, well, they argued in the case that Humphrey's executor was due to be overturned because it was unconstitutional. But I think, as we'll discuss a little bit more, the Supreme Court hasn't gone there, at least not yet. As far as I know, the name of that precedential case, Humphrey's executor, doesn't appear any place in the decision that the Supreme Court entered.
So Barb, Joyce has talked about what the government argued. What did Wilcox and Harris argue?
Yeah, so they said that before they could be fired, they have to show just cause. Remember, these are independent federal agencies created by Congress. The NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, that's where Gwynne Wilcox was working, and the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is where Kathy Harris was working, that is the agency that reviews the firing of federal employees to make sure that their rights were not violated, that there really was cause when they were violated. And so what they said is, unlike some federal employees, the statute that creates their position says they can be removed only for good cause. In addition, there has been some chipping away at all of this as to whether somebody is executing the law or making more quasi-judicial decisions. And one of the things they said is that their role is mostly an adjudicatory body. The NLRB and the Merit Systems Protection Board mostly hears cases about civil servants or about labor matters, and they apply laws that Congress has passed. And so to call that federal and to say something is within the purview of the president, even though the statute requires just cause, really does say the executive, the unitary executive, the president, does control everything in the executive branch. And of course, the red line for everybody has always been the Federal Reserve, because everybody's afraid Trump's going to fire people there and muck it up.
As Barb said, the order is unsigned, and there are three liberal justices who dissented and had a very different take, and they actually, of course, go ahead and really point out the absence of any consideration of Humphrey's executor in the order. And Joyce, they also go really far out of their way, because they're talking about firing an NLRB person and a MSBP board member. And they go out of their way to say, well, it would be different if you were firing Jerome Powell. It's like coming out of nowhere, they make this argument that it was one of the arguments made by Wilcox and Harris, that it would allow, they said, if you can do this to us, you could do it to the Federal Reserve. So why did they put that in? It's clearly dicta in this case, but they went out of their way to mention that.
Yeah, I mean, they did it to keep world markets from nosediving, right? Trump had been forced to walk back his earlier comments about firing Powell. The Supreme Court didn't want to make that same mistake. But as Justice Kagan points out in her dissent, the court didn't offer any sort of rigorous legal distinction, and the precedent set here could just as easily be applied, or not really the precedent, because this isn't really at a precedential stage, but the analysis that they used to reach this result, it applies to Powell, it applies to the Fed. There's no real legal principled stand going on here. This is the Supreme Court, or at least its conservative majority, entering the political fray. And I think this is too cute by halves, and it's going to come back to bite them, because we all know that if you give the Trump administration an inch, they'll take a mile, and they will be arguing down the road that they can fire Jerome Powell.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Well, now it's time for our favorite part of the show, where we get to answer listener questions. And boy, do y'all have a lot of good questions this week. This is one of those weeks where it's hard to stick to just three of them. But we do appreciate your questions. If you have one for us, email it to us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com, or you can tag us on social media using #sistersinlaw. But please keep asking so we can answer the questions that concern you the most. And if we don't get to your question during the show, keep an eye on our social media feeds during the week. We'll try to answer as many additional questions there. But this week, we've got three. Barb, the first one is for you from Bob, hopefully not my husband, Bob. But this Bob asks, why aren't judges holding officials of this administration civilly liable for contempt of court?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Bob. And the answer is, I don't know. I find these judges to be so, I don't know if the word is cautious, but, you know, look at Judge Boasberg, who found that the Trump administration had lied. He was on a path to do that. But even he first said, well, I'm going to make you show cause why I shouldn't hold you in contempt. There's always several steps. Now, I guess they want to be careful. They don't want to overstep their bounds. But man, we have seen now so many instances where judges are finding that orders have been violated. And yet we see so little of this contempt. And what you're talking about here is civil contempt. You know, criminal contempt means I'm punishing you for violating my order. Civil contempt is I'm going to jail you until you do what I've asked you to do. And so we've seen, you know, lawyers dragging their feet on orders, and judges have the power to say, I'm going to lock you up, or I'm going to fine you, $1,000 a day or more until you produce the information I've requested. Why aren't they doing that? You know, I suppose some of it is respect for the executive, and that's a good thing that they are not so quick to try to engage in fights with other branches of government. But at some point, I think it's the only way that, you know, they're going to get deterrence from this kind of behavior is by using their contempt power.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you so much, Barb. I think the reality is courts don't have armies, right? But they're not toothless tigers. I mean, they're not just incapable of taking any action to enforce their orders. And I think that's the moment we're headed towards. This is a president who wants to test that power. It's part of his unitary executive strategy. And we have to hope when that moment comes that there is a judge who gets it right and knows how to do it. So that, I think, is where we are. Our next question comes from Elizabeth, and she asks, why aren't people talking about the fact that Trump has already cost us over $26 million to play golf? Well, Elizabeth, I have not seen that statistic yet, which I think is the question that you're asking, right? Like Barb, I don't have a good answer to your question, but I do have a comment. And my comment is this. We must not take any of this stuff for granted. It becomes so easy to just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, that's Trump. You know, Trump accepted an airplane from the Qataris. Oh, that's just Trump. Trump is profiting heavily off of his meme coin. Oh, that's just Trump. Melania is making a lot of money making a documentary for Amazon. Oh, that's just the Trumps. I think that we should not take any of it for granted. We should continue to make a lot of noise about how inappropriate and improper this is for a president of the United States. The Supreme Court may want to give Trump a pass from criminal prosecution. I don't want to give him a pass from accountability when he strays from the path. And so I'm glad you asked the question. I think maybe I'll make a point in future episodes of making sure that we highlight the stuff that no president should do, but that this one is doing, particularly offensive when he's spending yours and my hard-earned money to do it. Jill, the last question is for you from Tara. When laws get struck down by judges as likely unconstitutional, how does that work exactly? Is it either constitutional or not? Can you elaborate on what that means? This is a great question.
It is a great question, and I can see why you are confused by the language. When a judge says it's likely unconstitutional, it's almost always in the context of deciding whether to put a stay on an action. And one of the grounds for staying something is to say, it's likely unconstitutional, and so I'm going to put a stay on your doing that while it is pending further analysis in the district court and then in the court of appeals. So you're right. When something is struck down as unconstitutional, when the Supreme Court, who's really the only the final say on such a thing, when the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional and has to not be used at all. But It's a standard that is used in temporary restraining orders and preliminary injunctions.
Thanks for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. Kim will be back next week. Follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law wherever you listen, and please give us a 5-star review, which really helps others find the show and makes us feel very good. Please show some love to this week's sponsors, Helix, Thrive Cosmetics, Calm, and Quince. The links are in the show notes. Supporting them makes this podcast possible. See you next week with a new episode, Hashtag Sisters-in-Law. Hey, so Jill, I just got a text message. You may find this to be very interesting. Judge Bates just granted summary judgment of a permanent injunction to block Donald Trump's executive order against Jenner and Block, your former law firm.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Yes. That is so righteous.